Hi ladies, it's Jo Martin here and welcome to the Soft Power Summit on this lovely Sunday. I'm the founder of One of Many. It's my absolute pleasure to be joined here today by the lovely Kathy Burke, whom I will introduce you to in just a moment. But you're participating in the Soft Power Summit, a fortnight of virtual lunch dates with some of UK and indeed the world's most inspiring leaders. We've had women from small business and big business. We're talking health, we're talking happiness, we're talking wealth, we're talking real world women's issues, as well as bringing a little flavor of equality and effectiveness to everything that we're focusing on. The conversation continues, as it always does, in the One of Many Voices forum. So do join us there on Facebook, facebook.com/groups/One of Many Voices. It'd be really great to have you there. And the Twitter handle that we're chatting away on is at One of Many Women. And we have our hashtag Soft Power Summit, of course. So do join us for the conversations throughout the course of the days ahead. We've had an amazing week so far, haven't we? We've spoken with Lisa Barnwell, Bumps in the Boardroom, to kick things off and let us know that we could be optimistic, because in the world of big business, we're starting to see companies put the money where their mouth is about making it an easier place for women to be, to have play all the roles that we're biologically given, namely being a mother as one of those key ones. And as well as continue on our trajectories through organizations. So that's very, very cool. We've spoken to Anne Wilson about wealth, Bernadette about business. We had a fantastic week so far. So today, here on Sunday, we are going to be speaking to the lovely Kathy Burke. Now, I asked Kathy to come on the summit a little last minute, not really last minute, but she's been in India for a couple of weeks and a couple of weeks in the last month. So it's been hard to get a hold of her. But I really wanted someone to come and give us the perspective of what soft power means, what soft power leadership means in the developing world. In areas like South Asia, in Africa, in South America. I wanted to talk about equality and effectiveness and perhaps to learn a little about leadership from some of the most unlikely leaders. And so that's why I have invited the lovely Kathy Burke to join us. Kathy is the CEO of The Hunger Project in Australia. Now, The Hunger Project is an awesome grassroots aid organisation that Greg and I have been investors in for a number of years now. I also am a volunteer and give a lot of my time to The Hunger Project in terms of supporting them with presentations and getting the message out there in a bigger way. And I love the work of The Hunger Project. I love the work of The Hunger Project because it doesn't kind of have any... because it's nimble and flexible, I suppose, is what I want to say about that. And in every country, how it works is a little bit different based upon the needs of the individual areas and countries it works within, and the needs of the individuals within the areas where it works. Because the way the Hunger Project does what it does is through incredible leverage of volunteers that are trained by the Hunger Project. So with a staff of around 400, the Hunger Project is able to reach a huge number of people, in excess of 20 million people, through a very small staff. And so this is all on a budget of less than 20 million a year. So it's quite extraordinary when you start looking at the numbers, and all of this happens through incredible leverage by training volunteer leaders who go into their communities, run workshops and train people in their areas, local areas, in amazing leadership so that they can facilitate the change. That's what I love about The Hunger Project. It's smart, it's leveraged, it's got women at the center, and it's very, very grassroots. Most of the smart business people I've spoken to, when you explain the model to them in more detail than I will now, you can go look at it on the website to find out all about it. They just go, wow, that's a really smart model. So it really is, and it makes good business sense. It's making good development sense, and it's really a study done by a group of McKinsey consultants, actually, who went out and did a work in Uganda to look at the work that the Hunger Project was doing, was saying that The Hunger Project really has cracked the code on creating sustainable change in areas, which I'm really proud to be a part of them. But even more than the Hunger Project, I'm really proud to call Kathy Burke a friend. I often get asked who I look up to in the world, and Kathy Burke is one of those people. She's extraordinary, and I'm really grateful to have her on the call with us. She's been involved with the Hunger Project as a volunteer for many, many years now, and indeed she's been CEO of the Hunger Project in Australia for over 10 years. I think she's been on staff with them for a great number of years. I'm sure she'll tell us all about that. But started out life in the political sphere. So she's always been an activist and a campaigner of some sort. And she's very well educated, very switched on when it comes to global issues. And she's spoken to the movers and shakers all around the world. And she's here to share with us what equality looks like in areas where perhaps we're not present to it, and where we don't have firsthand experience. And what does it really mean to be effective when the deck is stacked against you in an area where gender is nowhere near as much of a headline issue, perhaps, as it is here in the West? So, Kathy, thank you so much for joining me for the Soft Power Summit. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Miss Joey. I'm thrilled to be here.
I know it was a bit of a last-minute arrangement, but I knew that you would have all of the answers to the questions that we had, because it seemed odd to me to be running our summit, our fortnight of virtual lunch dates, talking about equality without having someone who's as well-versed as you are in what does equality look like in the developing world, you know, and with your work through the Hunger Project. I know that you've had decades of experience of seeing it. You've seen things shifting over time as well. And I think you've probably got some good perspectives to share on that. So before we jump into all that yummy stuff, I wonder if you could just start by giving the ladies a bit of an idea about you and how you came to be the CEO of the Hunger Project in Australia, because it is it's quite a great story, really.
Well, I've been working at the Hunger Project now since 1997. So, God, wow, that's actually 18 years. Doesn't seem like that long, and yet it does seem like that long as well. I made my way there actually when I was a very young mum. I came in contact with the Hunger Project, and my husband and I were asked to become what we call investors in our work, and we gave a substantial amount of money, which we had thought at the time, what? We can't afford that. Mm. Got this young baby. That's crazy. And go on a leadership journey to the Hunger Project in Ethiopia. But something really, a deeper truth spoke to me about, you know what, we're going to be fine, our kid's going to be fine, we don't have to worry about that. And I felt really called at a really deep level to see and experience and I guess own our whole world. And I went to Ethiopia, and that changed my life, and I was a volunteer for about 5 years after that. And then I eventually went on staff in 97 and became the CEO of the Hunger Project in Australia in 98.
Extraordinary. So it was very much that that trip to Ethiopia that made a big difference for you, wasn't it?
It was, but it was like a cascading effect. So right. I'd actually heard about the Hunger Project. I'd been involved in politics in I'm from Perth in Western Australia, and I was involved in the peace movement, and I was one of a team of seven who set up the Greens Party in WA and helped write their constitution, and I was really involved actively in that way. And I first heard about the Hunger Project then, and I was in my 20s. I was like, oh, God, you know, ending hunger, you're crazy. And then when I had my first child, actually, when I gave birth to her and held her in my arms, and something connected me to other women, and I thought, you know what, actually it's not okay that other women give birth to their children. They love their children like I love my daughter, and yet they don't expect her to survive or just the obstacles are so immense. Mm. And then I was receptive to when I then heard again about the Hunger Project a couple of years later. And it kind of connected me to my essence as a woman and taking a stand that I can't just have a nice life for myself and my kid and my beautiful world in Perth, living the dream. Mm. I can't live the dream fully and authentically whilst others can't. I just couldn't separate that from myself. And so that started me on the journey with the Hunger Project. And there was only a couple of years after that that I actually went to Ethiopia. So my journey, I guess, really was catalyzed by the birth of my first child.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because I can remember that moment with James having exactly the same experience, looking down at him and going, Gandhi's not going to come and fix this. If I want the world the way I want it, I'm going to have to step up and do something about it. So I can totally relate to that, because it is such a,
yeah.
And I think a lot of women who are mothers can very much relate to that this sense of, okay, you know, this is divine and wonderful, but you do get connected to something much bigger than yourself as well, I think, through that journey into motherhood, if you're open to it, certainly. So we've been talking a lot this week, Kathy, about equality, and oftentimes when we hear that conversation here in the West, whether that be the UK, Australia, the States, Europe, wherever, our assumption is, you know, equality between men and women. I you know, through the involvement that I've had with the Hunger Project, have had that expanded, you know, manifold, my definition of what that could and can mean and who I am in the world because of that. But one of the things, before we get into all that yumminess about what there is for us to learn about the transformational work being done with a lot of the women leaders that the Hunger Project works with so closely in tiny villages in Bangladesh and Uganda and Malawi. Before we get into that yummy stuff, I always am fascinated by your daily experience of equality. And you, for me, are a great mentor in this. The way that you and Steve have run your household over the years, you've got two kids of your own. You live in a great house in the countryside in Australia. And whenever I kind of start freaking out because I've got a trip away from James planned, I always think about you. So I wonder if you could share what your daily experience of, you know, of making it work, of the juggle is for you and Steve, with you leading an awesome organization that takes you away from your family an awful lot.
Well, what I say to people is that, so my children are now young adults, so my daughter's 24 and my son's 21, and you're right, they've grown up with physically absent traveling mother, and my husband's been the linchpin, stable, you know, constant physical presence at home. Mm. He's run his own businesses and done different stuff himself. But look, what I say to people actually, Joey, is that I have raised my children with a healthy degree of neglect. And you know what? They've turned out fine. Mm. They've turned out more than fine. They are fabulous, fabulous young adults. And in reflecting on that, I believe, and sometimes, and I hopefully I won't be up for too much judgment with the listeners, but sometimes I've been away for like 5, 6, 7 months a year.
Mm.
And not at one time, but I'll be away for two weeks per month. Even if you're away for 2 weeks every month, that's 6 months a year.
Mm.
And I'm never away for more than about three weeks, and including when they were younger, I wasn't. But I think that when we allow, so I've been fully at peace with my decision, and so is my husband. So we're fully on board.
There's was it always that any... way? Did
yeah,
it take
but
a...
I married. Yeah, but I married well, so I do. Steve's never said to me, "What, you're going away again?" Try to do some sort of guilt trip on me. So I've been very lucky in that regard. Mm. Obviously, I've missed them a lot.
Has it been hard, especially when they were younger?
Yeah, well, so I want to assure your listeners that I'm not like a serial killer. Don't have a cold-hearted heart of a serial killer.
She's actually a psychopath.
Exactly. I just think, you know what, when I'm home, they have a mother who's like so turned on, so happy, so present, so alive, so living her purpose. And
because it's not like you're off bloody drinking cocktails by a pool somewhere.
No, and I and you know, wasn't, yeah, that's right. And and I, by the time I went on staff, my kids were they were still young, 5 and 3 or something like that. But no, and I talked to them about it. And when I was home, I was like really, really present. So I've been a long term meditator. I learned to meditate in my early 20s. And so that's been a practice that stayed with me over many years. And so when I'm there, I really, really practice being present. So when I'd pick them up from the school bus, I'd make them dinner, I'd do their homework, I'd da 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 da. And then when I needed to, when they'd gone to bed, I may then have to do evening calls for different, because you know, obviously I work many time zones. But but being present, being alive, being joyful, being just being happy, that, and I'd include them in what I was doing. And because I guess I'd made my peace with it, and so had Steve, like with this united front. So even as children, because they do seek to find your weak spots and, you know, divide and conquer.
Yes,
and I
yes.
I say that with respect. But it's like, you know what? I'm like a mirror that they're just their little – their little hooks can't quite kind of gain any. Anyway, I've talked to them, as I said, the young adults, I've talked to them, they're fine. So
are they very proud of you that you've been
of
this,
course
now
they
that
are.
They're young adults and they kind of see the can kind of put the choices that you made in perspective, you know. I suppose they're present to a lot of families where mum's been around all of the time, but perhaps not had the sense of purpose and joy and amazing contribution that you've always demonstrated in the world. Do they see that and get that?
Yeah, they're very, very proud, and this is normal for them. So, yeah. You know, like, it's like, I guess, whatever's sort of normal. And because I don't have any, I'm not like guilt ridden, or and I'm not like cooking meals, sort of 2 weeks worth of meals and sticking them in the freezer because my husband can't kind of manage. Like the house can be an absolute mess and I'll just be like, see ya, and I'm out the door because I've got a flight to catch, whatever, and I come back, and it could be an absolute mess when I come back, and that's fine as well. Like, it's just a flow, a river. And yeah, I don't know, look, they say they're fine with it, Joey, but I'm fine with it, and this is my life. So I feel very deeply about my work and this amazing movement that's happening, this enlivening, this justice that's arising on the planet, and anything that I can do to fan the flames of that, fan the embers of that flame, I just feel I feel called to do it. So look, everything's a compromise, and I don't believe in work-life balance. I just feel if you make your peace with something, then others kind of make their peace with it as well.
I think there is a great lesson in this for those of us who have the guilty thing going on. I'm going to have some more conversations with you, Kathy, to work through this one.
Actually, I'm really good with guilt. What's so weird is that I was raised in a really strict Catholic household, went to a Catholic school. I'm one of 7 children. My father was called Francis Xavier, so like full Irish Catholic business going on. And in fact, I sort of coached 2 of my sisters actually in relation to my mum, who, you know, I love and adore, but her kind of So look, you have to buy into it or not. So I'm really good at coaching people around guilt because I just think it's a completely wasted, either choose to do something and just get into it and understanding that everything has a consequence. Catching an early morning flight means you might be tired. Spending a weekend at home having amazing sex with your husband for a whole week means that your house is not tidy. I mean, everything has a consequence. So just like when you've chosen what you're doing, then just get into it and don't, like, I think guilt is just like, I don't understand, fully understand guilt. I really don't. And it's not an emotion that I want to give any energy and oxygen to.
Oh,
so I'm really happy to take you on, Joey.
I am yours. It's so wonderful having the opportunity to interview people like this because I know on Thursday I'm going to be speaking to Shah Wasmond. And Shah Wasmond is just, she just has no time for fear. You're my have no time for guilt woman. I've got Shah who has no time for fear. I'll get all my biggies lined up and then I've got my little tribe, my circle, and I'm fine.
Absolutely.
I can't tell you how many times I'm making big choices to go do big things because of what we're up to in the world. You know, in part because of your influence on my life, mind you. So I hold you very responsible. And I think to myself, okay, what would Kathy do? She would just walk out and she'd go do her thing and she'd love every single minute of it. Right, that's what I'm going to do. You're such a great role model for that. So,
well, my children haven't turned out to be meth addicts or...
Your
I don't know
the
something
most delightfully
else, so.
Adjusted, fabulous kids. I think I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. So it's fabulous. It really, really is. And I think you've said the big part of it is not being plugged in. If you're plugged into the issue, then everyone else around you can get plugged into the issue and be wrong with it. But if you're at peace, you're at peace. And this has been one of the creating that sense of flow and presence at home. I'm sure has been one of the things that's actually enabled you to go out and make the massive difference in the world that you have made, that you've led. You, when it comes to leadership, I think, you know, people, I often get asked on interviews, you know, who are your mentors, which women do you admire? And you are always in my top three for this ability that you have just to be with the choices that you've made. And then your ability to be fine talking to, you know, a David Gonski, ex-chair of the Australian Stock Exchange, Australian Futures Fund, you know, mover and shaker of all things financial on a global scale, having a chat to him and a bit of a laugh, just as you are to have a chat to a Taslima in Bangladesh, a young woman who has two children and is busy supporting her own little self-help group that she's, you know, got together that's absolutely transforming her whole community. Your ability to operate across the spectrum of humanity and just be present with what's so and the real depth of who the authentic person is you're with, I just admire no end. And I'm sure that breadth of humanity has given you great scope for understanding what real equality is. I mean, what is it for you having with those sorts of experiences?
What is equality?
Mm.
I think equality for me in that context is appreciating, understanding, respecting the humanity that we all share. So, you know, I can and do meet with prime ministers, presidents, world leaders, and I do meet with a woman in a village who can't leave the four walls of her own bamboo hut. And it's being able to find that essence that makes us human and connects us and speaking from there. And I guess one of the things that I've really understand is that at the end of the day, we all want the same things. We are so similar and we want our kids to be okay. We want to know that our lives matter and we want to have a say in our life. And that's true whether I'm a male rickshaw driver and I spend 16 hours a day trying to make enough money to feed my family, or whether I'm a head of industry in New York, sort of, you know, running the world. We share these same sort of same things, but at a deeper level, I'm a very strong feminist, and I not only does it make sense in that if we have women in the villages and areas that we work who don't have access to education, who can't provide the protection and safety and nurturing for their children, it just doesn't make sense from a practical level, but also deeply from a justice level. I think that women and men need to have the space to bring forth what is uniquely theirs. Mm. And currently in the world, we don't have that space either for women or men, but particularly for women. Mm. So that's my take on us having a voice to express what it is that we need in the world and who we are in the world as well.
You speak there quite a bit to, you know, having opportunity, the equal opportunity. Do you think men and women, because there's this, in the feminism conversation, sometimes there's this collapse of definition that we are the same and we should be treated, well, not treated the same, but we are actually the same. Do you think men and women are the same, or do you think we have differing gifts?
Well, I think at a metaphysical level we are the same in that every human being is the same, and in fact taking it at a level deeper, there is actually no one outside of ourselves. So we do create the world that we live in, and you can see through quantum physics that the combination of atoms shows that there is actually no separation from one another. Mm. But at a practical level, are there differences between women and men? I do think there is a male energy and a female energy that we both partake of. Probably that conversation's best left to you, Joey, and others who are more confident in that area. I guess from my perspective is that when we live in a world that isn't allowing the space and the openness for women to say what they say, women typically do set a different agenda in an ideal world. Maybe in Scandinavia they've reached this nirvana, I don't know. But our issues tend to concern things like, and certainly this is true for 3 billion, 4 billion people in the world who can't access as a right the things that we take for granted, like getting our girls educated, like being able to go to the toilet without being raped, like not being married off at the age of 14. Whilst things like that are occurring in our world, it's a huge human rights injustice, and it also doesn't allow the world that we want to happen. So in that way, we are quite different.
It is something that just innately, what probably speaks to that, it's the feminine masculine energy thing, isn't it? Masculine energy is very much about achievement and competition and focusing on, you know, on a one thing, whereas that feminine energy is often around, it's about community and collaboration and nurturing and nourishing. It would make sense that when women are being empowered to step up and make these changes, that's kind of what the agenda becomes. It's not about, you know, our village being the best village in the area because blah, blah, blah. It's about, no, we just need to all have what we need and get that taken care of, please. So you've obviously you've seen a lot of transformation. There's a revolution happening, that's for sure, in the developing world. I think it was you who said this to me, Joe. We're not starting this. They're doing it. It's happening. And there's a lot to be learned from the women and men in South Asia, in Africa, in South America, in some of the poorest countries in the world. There's some extraordinary transformation occurring, which, for me, when I first started my journey with the Hunger Project, I came from what I think is a typical kind of middle class, you know, well, for me it was Australian background of thinking, oh, gee, if I went over there, I could probably really help. You know, I know a lot of things. I could probably teach them some stuff that might make a difference. And, oh, my God, I've had my thinking turned on its ear through being involved with the Hunger Project, because I have learned more. When I went to Bangladesh, especially on that trip with you, with investors in the Hunger Project, I expected to go feeling a healthy dose of pity, probably guilt, of all sorts of things, but I did not expect to feel humbled, to feel inspired, to feel in awe and like I have never been committed to anything in my whole life. You know, like when I saw the commitment of some of these women that we met in rural Bangladesh and what they'd achieved with scraps of time, frankly, when they were, you know, when you look at the fact that they were, you know, that they had families they needed to bring up, and they had, you know, farms that they were running. And when I say farms, I'm talking, you know, a few chickens and maybe some fish in a pond, and you know, the vegetables that they're growing around their areas or whatever. Where they've got all of this to do, and then still to actually be able to find time to transform their communities. I just walked away and went, oh my God, I've never got an excuse for anything ever again. I wonder if you would share with us perhaps a story of a woman like that who's really made a massive difference in your thinking and your, you know, perhaps a woman that you met that where you really got this sense of what's possible for you from her demonstration of leadership, what she's up to in the world.
Yeah, I've got so many women that have been so impactful, and men too, but women have been impactful for me. And I've been very well educated, and I absolutely hand in heart the lessons around leadership, about being a visionary leader, having courage, being resilient, being bold, being uncompromising. Being extraordinary, I've learnt from people that we tend to think don't have anything to teach us at all. And as you said, like we tend to look at people in the so-called third world as deserving of our pity and like, oh my God, what can I do for them? And I feel so bad, and let's do this, and let's, you know, I can help this, and I know how to, you know, blah, blah. And shifting that's been really key for me. A woman I've been, I mean, I've just come back from, it feels like tours of duty, but I was in India, and then I was back for about 2 weeks, and I went back again, and this is in Odisha, which is a really backward state, miles away from anywhere hip and fabulous in India. And I met a woman there called Sabrita who so represented to me. I learned a lot from talking to her, and essentially one of the big issues in this area, and let me paint a picture of India, because we think of shiny India and wonderful Bollywood and Sachin Tendulkar and great cricket and, you know, zillions of millionaires, but there really is another India, and India has the most number of hungry people living it than any other country in the world. They've got more than 300 million people living below the poverty line.
Wow.
And some of the stuff I've seen in India, Joey, is absolutely the worst that I've seen anywhere in the world. Mm. And so just being in her area a couple of weeks ago, so she's sort of top of mind, I guess, in this area, so she herself has limited education, so you can be non-literate, which means you have no literacy, or you can be neo-literate, which means you know how to write and sign your own name, but little more than that. And she was like that. She had that level of education. And one of the issues in her area was girl trafficking. And one of the drivers of girl trafficking is the choice is the preference for a male child. So sex selective abortion was really on the increase in this area. So one of the things that she was working on was having women, when they go to have an ultrasound, to decide to keep their child if it was going to be a girl.
Wow.
And there used to be, when I first travelled to India, in fact, until reasonably recently, I've been going back and forth to India for many, many years, used to these big billboards in Hindi that said, spend 5,000 now and save 500,000 rupees later, which meant let's go to an ultrasound clinic and terminate the female fetus for a cost, small cost, and save you the money in wedding expenses, dowry, education, all this sort of stuff.
I beg your pardon, this is on a billboard?
On a billboard. It's now illegal.
Oh, so you don't see those. God.
You don't see them anymore, but I have seen those. And it's still very much in the psyche that you prefer a male child for lots of different reasons. And so in this particular area, as in many areas, there are lots of ultrasound clinics, and you may be a farm labourer and earn 50 rupees a day, 60 rupees a day, not even enough to earn to eat protein. That's how poor you are, but you will afford the money for an ultrasound and a termination if it's a girl.
Oh.
Because girls have no value. It's a mindset shift that we're working to change.
Mm.
So Sabriti was because she'd been trained by the Hunger Project, and so one of the I was talking about girl trafficking. So what was happening was, because there's now fewer girls, the price of a girl, the value of a girl goes up, but not in the way that we would think. So what was happening in the area was that girls were being trafficked across to other states where the sex ratio is even lower than this area. So you have a whole generation of young men that will never have a bride. They'll never know love. They'll never have that relationship. And so people are coming to Sabriti's village, luring young girls and their families with, we'll give you some money, so therefore you don't have to pay for a wedding or a dowry or anything, and we'll marry your daughter and we'll send her to another state. But actually what was happening was she wasn't getting married, but it was a sham marriage, so not a real marriage. Not that they knew it at the time. And they were sent to another state, Joey, and this young girl, she might be 15, 16, 20, you know, whatever the age is, actually it's irrelevant, but she was married into a family of four or five sons. And she became the sex and domestic slave for that family of boys.
Oh, my goodness.
And she doesn't know the language. She's got no money. She's got no mobile phone. Whole series. And then when she finds out she's actually not married, the level of shame.
Oh.
And so this kind of – So Sabriti, one of her stuff, she stopped actually a few girls, literally they were on the train. She stopped the train from going, pulled the girls off the train and found them one girl in particular, work on a cashew farm. So she fixed a situation in a acute situation, right? Mm. So stopping that girl. But she was thinking, well, how do I stop this at a system level?
Mm.
And so mobilised a whole bunch of other women and talked to them, worked through working with the Hunger Project, and then would go door to door to door about the value of girls, but also would find out when is a young woman who's pregnant heading off to the ultrasound clinic, and then would go to her and talk to her. It's actually illegal to get abortion's legal in India, but sex selective abortion is not. So it's very hard to prove that that's what you're doing and why.
Yeah.
But then the women would go en masse to visit this woman who's pregnant and really to bring her down off the edge to encourage her to have a daughter, and then went door to door and ran campaigns about what these marriages are and what this trafficking actually is. So to try and talk to parents about, if someone comes to you and they offer you money and they offer X, Y, and Z procurements, it's not true, and this is actually what's happening. And they've started to bring some girls back to a village. And she was telling me this story, like, I mean, it's a freaking horrific story, but it's very common in this area. But her face, Joey, was so she was wearing this beautiful blue sari, and she was smiling, and she had this, like, gaggle of women around her. And I think this is one of the things I really want to impress on this whole group of women that we're talking to, is that she didn't do this on her own. She created a collective of other women. And what I find fascinating in India is that literally they're on top of you. So you'll know this from Bangladesh too, but like they can't stand any closer to you than what they're actually standing. And she was talking about this, but there were her people behind her. She's not like one lone voice. Mm. She has her collective with her. She's a really great example of leading with many and not like that kind of lone voice and that kind of ego, I'm going to do this and I'm going to stop this. she had a whole collective of women. And I actually asked the women standing around her, and I said, what is it about Savitri that you love? And like, why do you follow her? And they said, oh, because she, this is through an interpreter, because she does what she says she's going to do, and she, you know, she's up to stuff and all the sort of things that you'd expect. But Savitri still had this big smile, and I said, but what else is there about her? Like, I was fascinated. Like, why do we follow? Like, why follow this woman? And I said, is she fun? And, oh, there was about 15 women around her, and they all just laughed, and they said, she's so much fun, and they all, like, giggling in their own, like, local language. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but I totally got what they were saying. And
yeah,
she spoke from this, like, space of joy and, like, and love, and she wasn't ground down by, oh, my God, isn't this terrible. She appreciated how it was, but she focused on what she was going to do about it, and that gave her energy, that gave her life, that gave her joy, and that made it incredibly attractive for everybody else.
And because and it gave them that life and joy as well.
Totally. Mm. And then I was walking through a village, and I said to her a bit later on, are you scared for your life? Do you have fear? And she was like, no, why should I have fear? And I shouldn't have fear, and, you know, this whole sort of thing. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. And then, like, literally, Joey, a minute later, she talked about the death threat she has, the real because she's upsetting the status quo. She's upsetting a money ring in the village.
Yeah, of course.
But she was just like, so she said to me, no, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not afraid of my life. Like, why should I be? She was just like so defiant. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then later telling me that she actually has had death threats and this whole sort of stuff, but it hasn't cowed her. Mm. And I'm convinced that what hasn't cowed her was the support of the other women. It wasn't the other men, it was the other women, and they were standing with her.
Mm.
And I was just like, whew, who's my group of women? Who's my support to have me flourish in my own life in whatever the domain is? And that just really had me pause and think about how can I more consciously create a community of women, a support of women who have my back. Like, she was not standing there by her own. Mm. Women had her back.
Mm.
And I think that the more we can have each other's back, the more we can keep pushing forward into territory that may feel uncomfortable for us but we know is right.
It's so true. Well, Kathy, I'm there. I'm in your gaggle. I'm in your gaggle.
You so are, darling.
It's so interesting how you describe her, because that is exactly what I see in you, you know. And I often tell the story of when I started getting involved in the Hunger Project, that I started investing, you know, my hard-earned finances in the work of the Hunger Project long before I really understood the Hunger Project, simply because of your joy, passion and commitment. And I wanted to hang out with you more. So I can totally relate with the women standing around Savitri in that village in India, because I was one of those ladies.
Oh, that's so cute. That's so
really.
That's very sweet.
And I think there's but I actually think there's a good lesson in that, because I didn't really get this for myself until you've just shared that. That sometimes we feel as women and thinking about leadership and thinking about changing the world and being called to do stuff, that we've got to sit around and do our thing in our little house with our little family, doing our, you know, in our community, just living, until we get this massive big tap on the shoulder from God saying, here's your big calling, go do this thing. And you know what? That is not how I have got to be living the life of purpose that I'm living now and that I feel blessed to live. It was literally by riding on the coattails of people I like hanging out with to start with.
So cool.
You know?
Yeah.
And I remember a mate of mine actually who was one of the instigators of us getting introduced, Simon Carter. So I was, you know, I was in volunteering with a network with Simon years and years ago in Sydney, and we were creating this purpose for our network, and we were saying it was about contribution. And I said to Simon, yeah, but I don't really feel like I'm about contribution. I feel a bit bad saying that's what the network is about. He said, Joe, you're sitting here on a Sunday organizing the purpose, you know, crafting the purpose of a network of people where we get over 50 people come every week to talk about, you know, giving back and making the world a better place. If you're not expressing contribution in the world, I don't know what is. And it just really got me that what I, you know, and that was kind of in my early journey, I just saw it as hanging out with really passionate, cool, fun people that made me laugh, that were up to big things, and I just wanted some of their passion in my life. And by hanging out with those kind of people, I've investigated into my own purpose deeper. I've got to know myself more fully. I've had the opportunities to meet, to meet extraordinary leaders, you know, like you've just been describing here for me on my trip to Bangladesh, and getting to know myself deeper. But if it wasn't being okay with the fact that I just wanted to hang out with cool people who are up to things when I didn't yet have that emotional connection directly to the cause, if I hadn't given myself permission to just go for it because intellectually it made sense to me and these were fun people, like that was the recipe, it makes sense to help others when I've got so much, some way, whatever that is, let's find an intelligent model for that and these are cool people to hang out with. If I'd had some kind of it's got to be more important or more special or have been more reverential, or I would never be doing what I'm doing. I would still be sitting around waiting for it to arrive, you know. Because I don't know about you, I'd be interested on your thoughts on this, Kathy, because something that it bugs me a little bit is when I talk to women who are well-to-do, and by well-to-do I mean, well-to-do in our middle-class society. They might not be the richest in the world, but they've got, you know, they've got enough. They're taken care of. And they talk about, wanting to help other women to become financially, financially empowered or whatever. And I'll say, yeah, because, you know, we have to find, you know, my take on this is we've got to have our own economic liberation, as we were talking to Anne Wilson about, so that we can mobilize more here in the West. This is our job, to mobilize money to facilitate the transformation globally for women. This is deeply what I feel. And then sometimes these women say, and even if that's just so that they've got, even if enough for them is enough for them and their family and a little left over to have some fun. And I almost want to poke their eyes out because it's like there's a part of me that's like, no, I have this feeling of, and maybe I'm being very judgmental, I probably am, but I feel like if the drive is just to have a good life for you and your family, it feels like you're cutting yourself off from so what could be so much more. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I love your judgmental side, Joey Martin. Never change, my beautiful starfish. Look, I think for some people that's where they're at. And that's it. And it's very seductive, and I it's very comfortable. And for some people, that genuinely is where they're at. And wanting it to be another way isn't going to make it any different. So I think the energy to focus on is, well, who are our people that, you know what, they've got what they need, but what else is there, and how can I be what George Bernard Shaw talked about, a beautiful bright candle that is fully burnt and used at the end of our lives, and that we had it be about more than just us, and in doing so it gave us our life. Who are those people, and let's play with them? Because I just think everyone's at their own space in their own journey for their own reason.
That's true, and Lynn Twist has that great story in her book when she went to visit Mother Teresa. And the and there was a very wealthy Indian couple, I believe, that came in whilst she was speaking to Mother Teresa, and they came in because they'd missed out on their photo opportunity with her, and they sat down next to Mother Teresa, and apparently the woman, even at one point, you know, Mother Teresa with her the dowager's hump, the bent neck, actually physically lifted up Mother Teresa's chin so that her face was in the photo. And took the photo and then bustled their way out, and off they went. And Lynn tells a story about being absolutely mortified, horrified about this what she'd witnessed. And she didn't say anything at the time, but felt compelled to write to Mother Teresa afterwards about how shocked and how horrific it was, and this is what we have to change, and what do we do, and blah, blah, blah. And apparently Mother Teresa wrote back to her and said, well, you have infinite amount of compassion for the poorest of the poor, but we need to have that same compassion for the richest of the rich, you know. And that speaks to exactly where you started here, Kathy, about this humanity that we all share. We all do share that. So in your answer there and in that story, I feel suitably chastised. But geez, it bugs me. I guess because, and you know what it is, it's for many reasons, but because of how rich my life is, because of it, that juice is what I wish for everyone, you know?
Yeah.
And because for me it did start out so selfishly. You know, I just wanted to hang out with cool people like Kathy Burke, you know,
And who can blame you, because yeah, exactly. I'm like all kinds of awesome.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So so we've learned, I think, when it comes to soft power leadership, which is something we're talking about a lot, and there is that great political book around soft power, speaking to speaking to co-optation and so on at a political level. But I believe it's a great term to summarize the way that women in their feminine lead. And you've given us a great example of this I've forgotten her name. Sabriti today. This ability to have a vision and be committed and bold and tenacious around it. But I think what's really important is also hearing this, that it's about leadership of the group. It's about having other women and men stand with us to achieve this. Are there any other characteristics of this kind of bold leadership that you've witnessed that you think we need to be present to?
That's a good segue, Joey, for me to talk about my book, Unlikely Leaders.
Yes.
Lessons in Leadership from the Village Classroom. We have so much to learn. So I'm not sure how I can summarize it. I think at the end of the day, it's about how can we be fully human, to own all of our stuff, our snarky, untransformed bit of someone should do this, which could be, so we do this great exercise back in India called the Sheep and the Lion, which I love, and it's the women come together and there's a couple of people decide to be the sheep in the middle and then the rest of the fence, and there's one or two lions on the outside, and the exercise is for the lion to try and capture the sheep. And they try to get through the fence. But in the inquiry around it, and this is with the poorest women in India, they talk about, well, who's the sheep? And the sheep are the poor, the marginalized, the women, the disabled, and who are the lions? They're the moneylenders, they're the men, they're the power brokers. But then the question's flipped back, Joey, and it's like, well, when are you being the lion? And there's a really big pause, and women really reflect, when am I being taking what's not rightfully mine? And there's a great conversation I've heard women say, well, when I'm a mother-in-law, and when I'm really cruel to my daughter-in-law, or when I'm this, when I'm that. And I love that reflection in our own humanity, that we're so much more than what we think we are. We are the shade and we are the light, and I think we need to own both, because only in owning both can we harness that and also have compassion for others who may be more shade than light. So rather than demonizing and polarizing and making people wrong, it's like, how are we part of this system, this, and how am I also like that? So I think it's not just a matter of trying to take on the good aspects, but it's also acknowledging within ourselves that I can be mean, I can be judgmental, I can want security, damn it, I want money, I want my kids to be okay and stuff everybody else.
Yes.
And I think that's fine. That's like totally fine. And what else is available?
Mm.
So I think it's just being able to fully own the whole essence of what it means to be human and not try to pretend that we're anything other than what we are. We're messy, we're conflicted, we're you know, we're beautiful, we're glorious. And how can we bring that full love forward in the world, owning all of it and being able to then accept in our midst the change that then needs to happen.
Mm. Kathy, put beautifully, our wonderful, glorious, loving, messy, chaotic selves.
Absolutely. That's what we are. God, I mean, as I said at the beginning, you're right, everything's a compromise. You can't have amazing sex with your husband all weekend and still have a clean kitchen. It's not possible. So how can you be in the presence of both dichotomies and have it be okay?
Oh, I love it. That's a really lovely place for us to finish. So if the stories that you've heard today, gang, have inspired you, and you're interested in connecting more with the work of the Hunger Project, indeed getting in touch with Kathy when her book is coming out. Her Twitter handle is at Kathy P. Burke, as you can see there on the slide. And there's a couple of addresses that I've put there for you. One is if you email thpa@thp.org, that will get you hooked up with Kathy and the Australian Hunger Project team. And we also have the UK team over here. Sophie Noonan is the fabulous country director over here in the UK, a great friend of mine, and happy to introduce you there too. You can connect with them via the website too at thp.org.uk over here. Kathy, is there anything you'd like to leave us with as we wrap up here today?
I could burst into a song, but I don't think I will. No, darling, just thank you for the opportunity to talk to these beautiful women and, nothing else.
Thank you. I think you've taken us on quite a delicious personal and transformational journey today. So I'm very, very grateful for it. Thank you for spending the day with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Joey. Thanks, everyone.
So ladies, if you know that the time is coming for you to step up, become an even more powerful leader than you currently are, and you're feeling called to make a difference in some way, or you just want to hang out with really cool people like us, then I highly recommend that you get yourself plugged into the One of Many community by attending our next One Woman Conference. The next One Woman Conference is happening on the 5th to the 7th of June, and it'd be great to have you along to this intensive weekend of transformational soft power. You will not recognize yourself when you leave. Now, one of the things about the One Woman Conference, you can't get registered for it yet. Tickets will be going on sale for the conference on this Thursday, April the 23rd. Tickets are going on sale after our final interview of the summit, which is at 1 p.m. The tickets will go on sale. Having said that, if you are on our priority access waiting list, you will get invited to get your ticket a full 4 hours before anybody else. And with the numbers that we've had registered for the summit and the hundreds, literally hundreds of people that we have on that priority access list, I think it would be a very smart thing to do if you're thinking about joining us for the conference this year, because places are limited. We do only have a couple hundred places at the One Woman Conference, and I think those will sell out very, very quickly. And not only that, if you are on the priority access waiting list, you get to enjoy 50% off the lowest possible price to the One Woman Conference. It's a steal as it is already. The normal price is £197. With an early bird discount and 50% off, you get access to it for a ridiculously low sum. The reason for this is because we're really committed to getting this message out in a big way. Our vision is 1 million soft power leaders here in the West, So to partner with our incredible, incredibly inspiring leaders doing amazing things in the developing world. So our job is to get as many women as we can stepping into their soft power leadership. Tickets will go on sale for the One Woman Conference at 9 a.m. this Thursday if you're on the priority access list, or 1 p.m. if you're not. And if it's of interest to you, I'd say get on that list because you get a really big discount for that. Tomorrow, we are talking to Karen Nola, the founder of the rawfoodcoach.com and creator of International Raw Food Day. If you've ever wanted to speak to someone who created their own International Day of, then we're going to be talking to Karen tomorrow, because all of this commitment to transformation, breaking through around our wealth, around business, in our relationships, in terms of our leadership and making a difference in the world, as we've been speaking with Kathy today, it takes some energy, right? So tomorrow we're talking about energy for life with Karen Nola and how we can best harness our uniquely feminine aspects of our energy tomorrow. Over the rest of the summit, we're talking, continuing to talk big business, small business, maternity, wealth, health, human rights, and global development, ladies. So do join me for the rest of the week. We have this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to go. And we are taking registrations for the summit right throughout the course of the summit ahead. So if you've got friends, sisters, girlfriends, mothers, aunts, and cousins who would like to join us, please do tell them to come and join us at oneofmany.co.uk/summit and make the most of the few interviews we have left today. Look forward to speaking to you tomorrow at noon for a raw food lunch with Karen Nola. Bye.